You can interact with us so many ways. Go to www.emsgarage.com. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com. Go to our Twitter account, @emsgarage. Or you can download us on iTunes. Just search EMS Garage. You can also call us, 303-720-6001.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone. They want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Yeah, I'm going to 22 is on scene.
Hi, welcome to the EMS Garage. Thanks for joining us this week. It's an interesting week. I'm going to apologize right up front. The podcast was a little rough. We had some technical issues. We tried to tape Monday, Tuesday, and we ended up taping on Thursday. Unfortunately, the Monday and Tuesday podcasts were full, but I was in a hotel and really couldn't get the bandwidth we needed. So we ended up taping on Thursday night, and I don't know if the internet was going crazy that night or what. I could hear everybody fine, but they couldn't hear me, and so you'll see the less than stellar results of this podcast. So this week we're talking about C-collaring and a topic that Dr. Bledsoe brought up to us. And we really tried to bring together some of the best research and ideas in this. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of research into C-collars. So listen, enjoy. Next week it's going to be a lot of fun too. So continue listening and sorry about this week, but it's still a lot of fun. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage. It's the weekly podcast about all things EMS, and including some of the things that maybe you'll enjoy. So we're having some news and some information this week, and I think you're going to find this week's topic very interesting. Dr. Bledsoe sent us an email about this research that had recently been done on not C-collaring people. And so that kind of flared up some conversation. So we're going to talk about that tonight. And we'll probably talk about a few other issues. But joining me tonight is Mr. Tim Noonan on this cell phone, on his new... You have a G1, right?
For now.
You're not sure if you like it, huh?
Oh, I'm still learning how it works. And it's completely different from a BlackBerry.
Gotcha. Well, I hope you can work through it and you sound very clear. So thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Dr. Dave Ross from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hello, sir.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Hey, we're good. Hey, how have you been? It's been, well, you were on last week, but other than that, it's been a while. Did you make it down to NASP?
For me?
Yeah, absolutely.
I did make it to NAMSP, and I enjoyed myself. I thought it was really good. In fact, it's in comparison to the conferences that I go to, I have to say that I've gone 2 years in a row, and this really probably is the best conference that I go to now of anything that I do, because I just find the presentations are innovative, they're well done, presented by people who are really knowledgeable. And, I might be a little euphoric here and I maybe need some medication, but I was pretty excited with the last two NAMSP conferences that I've gone to.
Have you ever been to the Eagles or no?
No, I haven't. I think the Eagles is typically made up of medical directors of the top, the largest 30 EMS operations in the country, and I guess we don't qualify per se. I mean, you can always go as an attendee, but the people that kind of put it on generally emanate from the largest 30 operations. And I have never gone. Sometime I probably will go. They do very short presentations, I understand, so like 10-minute presentations. So they have many, many topics, obviously, and a huge array of speakers, but they can find themselves to 10-minute presentations. I hear that's really good, but I just haven't attended at all.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I was always curious maybe what was better or which may be better, the better conference, NAMESP or the Eagles, and maybe they're both worthwhile. I don't know. Well, thanks for joining us anyway. Also joining us tonight, Mr. Kyle David Bates, who's off.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Chris, how are you? See, you know me too well.
I know. I can hear your mute come on and off. That's pretty funny. How you been? I hear it's cold.
Oh, yeah. I'm getting ready to go into work. It's going to be 8 degrees tonight. Just ambient. Wind chill is probably going to be in the negatives. It's going to be blowing, snowing 7 inches in the next 5 hours they're expecting. So it'll be fun.
Oh, sounds lovely. And are you working 24 or just 12?
No, 8. Ooh. We work 8.
You work 8?
Work 8. That's very cool. Nice.
That's
no.
Very cool. Right on. Well, I hope you stay warm and you are. It's nice and not too busy tonight for you.
I'm gonna hide in my office, I'm hoping.
That sounds very good. Well, tonight, you know, I wanted to talk about this. I'm losing my mind. I can't think of this paper that Dr. Bledsoe sent over to us, and it was talking about extrication collars and the abnormal separation between the vertebrae and the in the presence of a dissociative injury. And some of the background is C collars are applied to millions of trauma victims with the intent of protecting against secondary C-spine injuries. Adverse clinical outcomes during the management of trauma patients led to the hypothesis that extrication collars may be harmful in some cases. The literature provides indirect support for this observation. Did you guys have a chance to read the paper, and what's your thoughts on that?
I did. I found it interesting.
Well, I read it, and I thought it was interesting also. I thought it was a... Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Dr. Ross. You're good.
Chris?
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Ross.
Okay, I agree. I thought it was interesting. It's a very sort of innovative idea and look at it, and what they did basically was dissect out, I think, 11 cadavers. I don't remember the exact number, but it was somewhere in that vicinity, and it looked like they were pretty freshly dead. In other words, they hadn't been dead for too long. And they did very, very careful dissections and removed the ligaments in a portion of the neck area that attached to the cervical vertebrae, and then they applied, as you said, a dissociative or kind of a vertical-type injury fracture complex to the C1 and C2. And then they went ahead and they applied a cervical collar, a standard, hard collar, and looked at how much more distraction they got radiographically than what they had beforehand. And it was pretty significant, actually. So I thought it was a really creative idea. I don't know exactly what devious mind would actually come up with this idea, because it really does involve some thinking, but it was pretty well thought out, and it was pretty well executed and interesting.
Now, Dr. Ross, do you think that the sample size was a little too small or needs to be recreated to prove the results, or do you think that the science behind it was really good? And Tim could probably answer that as well. So Dr. Ross and then Tim.
I would say, Chris, I don't know the answer to that exactly. I think it's an innovative thought and an idea that they came up with. It sort of makes you stop and think. But the question is, how representative of this is it in terms of reality? And there are many, many other factors that protect a patient's neck besides a cervical collar. So when somebody, first of all, this injury itself is likely to be fatal that they imposed on the cadavers. And if it isn't, it's highly unstable. But these are rare. rare birds in real world, and you would normally have a lot of your ligaments and neck muscles intact, which would help stabilize it at least. So the reality of encountering this type of injury, the way they've done this in the real world, is exceedingly small. And I think that you want to be careful not to extrapolate this particular injury and the finding associated with it to all cervical spine injuries, because there are many other ones. Some are significant, some are not so much. And so I think that, you know, it's thought-provoking, but probably is nowhere near enough to change our practice right now.
And Tim, how do you feel about that?
Well, it was only nine cadavers that they had, but still they found that there was increased dissociation with all of the cadavers when they applied the collar. So they described it as being a typical collar. It's not one that I use regularly, but it is adjustable in size, and they say that everybody was trained appropriately to use it. They used it according to their protocol. There wasn't anything wrong with the way the collar was applied. But when you look at the picture, it looks as if it is applying traction. And when you look at the results, that does seem to be the case. So there is something about what we're doing with these specific injuries, which is basically cutting all the ligaments that would hold the head down to the neck, and allowing the collar to cause some separation. What they recommend in their conclusions is that, they say, pending further evidence, a careful assessment of the cervical spine for the presence of a dissociative injury in severe trauma victims who arrive in a collar is prudent, particularly if the patient is obtunded or about to be sedated. So this is a very limited group of patients that it would apply to. Being cadavers, they have absolutely no control over any motion, so it's like dealing with a completely unconscious patient. And just gets us to pay more attention to, you know, what's going on with the neck when we're applying a collar. It's not what we might think is going on. Somehow we're putting traction on these patients when we really shouldn't be.
And Kyle, your initial thoughts or reactions to it as well?
I read through this and had a lot of the same thoughts as everyone else did. And I started thinking about other issues out there, such as, you know, the various studies that show that patients brought in POV did better than those brought in by CAR for certain traumas. I just sent out one now about the I just remembered this about the Malaysian study. I haven't had a chance to fully read it, where they had they looked at patients in the United States, New Mexico, and in Malaysia. Trauma victims, ones in Malaysia were not immobilized, ones in the U.S. were, and they had less neurological disability in the unimmobilized patients as opposed to those in the United States. And I'm just wondering if maybe the extrication collar is not the way to go. Maybe, you know, do we go back to the old soft collar, or even the Philadelphia style collars? Maybe the extrication collars we use today are just not really beneficial.
Well, let's think about, and maybe you guys can give us some insight, but go ahead, doctor. Well, I was just going to say, let's think about the origination of this practice that we started, because I remember when I started 20 years ago, we had these, you know, everybody got either you got the two-piece Philadelphia or you got the really soft collar, and we used sandbags. And the thought back then was we were just trying to stabilize. We were just trying to remind people to not move their neck. Now, obviously, if somebody's sedated or obtunded, you really can't remind them to move their neck. But maybe with all the technology, and there's really not been a lot of science behind the development of C-collars, maybe we have created a market and a demand for something that really isn't there. Dr. Ross, go ahead.
Well, I would say this. I'm very familiar with the article that Kyle just posted to us, and that's by Hounsworth and a group of people from New Mexico. And you're right that when you compared patients who were pretty well controlled for mechanism in Malaysia, because they wouldn't dare try this in the United States for medical legal reasons, those people who arrived by some sort of private conveyance versus patients who were controlled fairly similarly but arrived to hospitals in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, immobilized and in an ambulance, there was a trend to better neurologic outcomes in the Malaysians than the New Mexicans. So there's all kinds of controversy involved in immobilization. But I think it's really important that to say that we don't know for sure, and that, you know, this article, the one that we're talking about tonight on the cadaver study, is provocative. It's interesting, but I think there's nowhere near enough information to change practices, and that includes what style of collar we're using or not using. But it's really interesting, and part of the problem is that of all of the patients who get immobilized in this country, probably 1% or less have true, you know, vertebral column pathology. Most people do not. So we're dealing with a relatively small number of patients and a lot of over-immobilization. And this all started, I think, back in the 70s when somehow, somewhere, and I don't know what the index case was, somebody showed up at a hospital, not immobilized, had a potentially salvageable cervical injury, and because they weren't protected very well in the field or in the initial stages of their medical care in the hospital, a bad result occurred, and the American Academy of Orthopedics decreed that, you know, everybody that was involved in a trauma in the 70s should be immobilized. And that's kind of where we all went with this thing, and just about everybody under the sun was getting immobilized. You know, the New Mexico study raises questions as to whether or not that's beneficial in everybody or whether it's potentially a detriment. But this study, I think, that we're talking about doesn't really answer that question. It doesn't really solve anything. It just kind of raises the question as to whether or not we should be just immobilizing people. I think everybody agrees that if you've got somebody who has spinal instability or suspected spinal instability, they shouldn't be moving around. And if the best thing is ultimately to sandbag them and tape them to achieve that and not really put traction, such as this caller did in this study, well, that's probably a good thing to do. But I just think you can't really say for sure on the basis of this particular study.
Now, I wish we had a bigger group. I'm just wondering, are you folks using selective immobilization in your states?
We do, and I don't know if you are, Chris, but we have what we call the field evaluation protocol, and it's based on what's called the Nexus criteria, and that's the criteria that's been most studied in emergency departments, but it's also been studied in the field very extensively. So, we are doing that, it's been generally successful. We have had some people violate the protocol, and occasionally we don't immobilize people that should be immobilized. But I think overall, it's been generally pretty good, and that's been in place here in our area for 2 years.
Yeah, we do something very similar, and we're actually moving more and more away from immobilizing everybody, you know, just based on mechanism or whatever, and really making just going through the nexus. And making sure, based on that Nexus study, that all of our patients are doing that. And we're actually implementing that protocol this month to really move more and more away from immobilizing a lot of people. And especially for us, I mean, you know, you've got a patient on a backboard for 45 minutes to an hour driving down the highway. It's not very comfortable. So we're really making sure that we only do it for the patients that really will benefit, quote-unquote, from needing to be immobilized. So, Tim, how about you guys? Do you guys selectively immobilize in there in Pennsylvania?
some places do and some places don't, even though we have a statewide protocol. I think a lot depends on the hospitals that we're transporting to. When you show up at the hospital and the nurse or doctor screams at you that you know, you could be paralyzing somebody by not immobilizing, that gets some people to revert to anybody with any kind of mechanism gets mobilized. We're not at the cutting edge on anything on immobilization, either end. And it would be nice to see some more research of what is our role in protecting people who have unstable spinal injuries, because we don't know what works to protect them. The Haswald study from Malaysia shows that there's less than a 2% chance that there is any benefit from spinal immobilization, even with unstable fractures. But it's also not large enough to be conclusive. You know, is there something about putting somebody on a backboard that actually worsens the injury? We don't know. Is there something about the spinal collar that worsens the injury? We don't know. The backboard wasn't even supposed to be a transport device, just an extrication device, but we've come up with a way to strap people down so that we feel we can give Mr. Toad's wild ride through the town to the trauma center, and, you know, if we strap them down tight enough, then we can drive as recklessly as possible. That's not the purpose of spinal mobilization.
Good point. And Kyle, what about you guys there in Tonawanda?
Yeah, New York finally put a selective spinal mobilization protocol in, and you know, it's kind of funny because you go back to those years where, you know, you look at the patient going, they don't need spinal immobilization, but you did because, well, that's what we had to do, and it kind of falls into the same aspect, you know, with that. I also worked up in Maine for a couple of years, and they did a very large study of selective immobilization. I think it was something around 5,000 individual patients in that, and they had very good outcomes with that. Pretty intensive evaluation process, but they had good luck with it, even at the EMT level. They had very good luck at, you know, who needed immobilization and who didn't need immobilization. I think out of all those patients, there's only one patient that actually should have been immobilized, or, you know, actually had an injury that needed immobilization, but the way they presented, they didn't fit into the criteria.
Well, could we all agree then that maybe spinal...
Yeah, and I think there's actually a study, I can't quote it, but...
Sorry, poor Dr. Ross.
I was just going to say that I think there's a...
I will edit
this
carefully. No, I'll edit it. It sounds like you're on a delay for some reason. Go ahead.
Sure.
Go ahead with your comment.
Yeah, I don't know. You guys are kind of cutting in and cutting out, and I'm only getting about half of what you're saying, so I'm having to fill in the blanks, and that could be dangerous, I suppose. But I was just going to say that there is actually a study, and I can find it, but it looked at EMT basics assessing the need for spinal immobilization, and it turns out, not necessarily surprisingly, that a well-trained EMT can do a very fine job in applying the Nexus criteria and successfully deciding, you know, who can immobilize and who can't. But when I kind of broached this concept with some of my volunteer agencies who are almost exclusively basic, they get very, very nervous and very uncomfortable. And so for a low-volume volunteer service that's BLS, as much as I think it's a good thing for patients to have selective immobilization, reality is training and keeping people up to speed and comfortable in a low-volume volunteer rank circumstances, probably not worth it. I mean, it's just probably better to immobilize them. But there are some papers out there that suggest that, you know, basics can do a fine job. And the key is a good quality assessment and knowing what you're looking for. And inevitably, when that fails, regardless of what level the person is, you know, there's a problem in the assessment. They didn't do something, or they didn't appreciate what they found. At least in our system, I found that.
Dr. Ross, what's your stance on You know, we train EMTs, volunteer or otherwise, to immobilize something. And if we had spent just as much time to train them how to accurately diagnose when somebody needs to go on a backboard, wouldn't that be just as prudent? And wouldn't they then, maybe it's because that's the way they've always done it, so they're afraid of the change? Or do you really feel like they don't feel confident enough in the skill? Because I'm sure that they assess people for other things all the time, and they're very confident in those skills.
Yeah, I think that it's I think it's all of those things, and it depends on where they are and how many calls they're actually running. But no question, the training, I think, in school sort of emphasizes the need to immobilize. They really haven't yet gotten to a point where they're teaching selective immobilization. So their training is, when in doubt at all, just go ahead and immobilize. And that's very difficult to overcome, especially when, you don't run a lot of calls and, you're doing something else most of the time, maybe 70-80% of the time you have a different occupation. So those are real factors, at least I find, that are very, very tough to overcome. But somebody that's busy, that's working a lot, that's doing a lot of calls, it's a bit different story. And to me, I think, well, there's a whole lot of exception to this. To me, the biggest difference isn't between a paramedic and an EMT is really not, what kind of skills the paramedic has and what drugs they can give and everything else, but it's the level of assessment of the patient. And don't get me wrong, there are people that still have trouble at the paramedic level doing that adequately, but by and large, my experience is where I find holes is in the EMT basic level in terms of doing an assessment of the patient physically and then kind of understanding and interpreting what it is they're finding and acting on it. And to me, I think you could go a long way with a BLS provider if they're capable of doing a very good assessment and coming up with a plan based on what they're finding. And to me, that's one of the big differences between the average EMT and the average paramedic.
But, I think, though, most people, they don't backboard people because, ooh, he may have a spinal injury or, this is what's good for the patient. It's, oh, well, I'm going to get sued or this is what the lawyer says. And I also look at it as a lazy way. I really have to say it because, up in Maine, we have fire departments that barely run any calls a year and ones that run a little bit more. And they had a very good success rate, in those areas. And it was actually protocol. You don't put them on the backboards because we've seen what happens to patients that are relying on backboards, especially with extended transport times. And then as well as, prolonged, stay on a backboard in an ED. And I think the hardest part is going to be the lawyers. We're never going to get them out of it. But they shouldn't look at it as a quick fix. They should look at everything and going like what you said, Dr. Ross, is they need to learn to assess. But I think us as educators and instructors and mentors, we need to start taking these folks by the hand and showing them, the proper way to assess these patients and that not everybody needs the backboard because they actually may do some harm in some instances.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that. And the thing is that there's a lot of research out there, to support the idea of what you're talking about, Kyle, because, the people have studied thousands and thousands of patients, both in the emergency department setting and in the pre-hospital setting. So the evidence is there. I mean, the evidence is there that if you follow, essentially for the purposes of EMS, if you follow the what are called the Nexus criteria, that you're going to be very well protected by the weight of medical evidence if you do that properly. Now, this doesn't protect the medic who doesn't follow that, even whether they've got a protocol or not. In fact, it's probably worse if you have a protocol that says you'll do this, this, and this, and that'll determine whether you clear a patient or not, and you fail to do it. That's the problem. But if you've got a protocol and you're training people and people are following it, it's extremely rare that they're going to come up with a unrecognized spinal injury. But if they do and everything was followed, I think you're probably much better protected in the event that somebody should sue. But keep in mind that most of the time, and this is not an excuse to be sloppy, but most of the time we're dealing with 1% of all of our immobilized patients having a real spinal injury of any significance. So we're dealing with a relatively small number of patients here.
And of course, that's what you look at is one of the number one defenses in trauma is, or in litigation is trauma. You know, did it actually happen prior to the care?
Right, and we all have to be very cognizant when we start documenting that too, that the patient was up and walking prior to arrival or wasn't, you know, and really document their mobility. And I think in the back of my head, for some reason I hear Will Dunn saying and probably screaming, you know, the studies prove that only 1% of the people actually have a neck injury, and those people are really the ones that don't even, and there's really never been any study that shows that there's a benefit either way, even after they have a neck injury if we immobilize them. So I don't know.
Exactly.
And
right. I agree with that. Yep. However, there isn't enough anywhere near the evidence to sort of change our practice dramatically. But it's probably, I like to think of this as the sort of the analogy of jumping out of an airplane without a parachute. You know, we don't need a study to say that you're going to splat in all likelihood if you do that. Common sense tells us that, you know, if we were stupid enough to jump out of an airplane, it sure would be nice to have a parachute. You have a higher likelihood of surviving that. And I think that's, there's something still that we can learn from that analogy to this. If you've got somebody with an unstable spinal injury, it's probably not a great idea for them to be walking around and moving. Now, after that, all bets are off. What should we put them on to keep them from moving? Should it be a cot? Should it be a plastic surface board? Should it be a wood surface board? Should it be a metal surface board? Should it be something that's lined with foam? Should it be something that is, you know, an air mattress? All of those things, no one knows. You know, that in fact, no, the studies haven't been done, and probably all of them are pretty equally efficacious. Some have better comfort than others, and that's a real issue. But what we should be immobilizing them to and how we should do it, yeah, no one knows for sure. But the converse of that is they probably shouldn't be up and around, or at least we shouldn't let them be up and around, you know, if we really realize that they've got an unstable spinal injury. I mean, it's just probably not a good idea.
Well, here's the real question. If it were you or your family, what would you choose?
I would prefer to go with that spinal immobilization.
If it were me, I'm sorry. I missed kind of what your comment was. Were you asking, Chris, if it were us with a spinal injury, how would we want to be treated?
Yeah, exactly. How would you want to go?
Yeah, I think I'd want to not be moving. I think that I'd take my chances on being immobilized. But, you know, and it would depend on the circumstance from there. There are people you just can't clear for whatever reason. And, you know, they may be bogus completely. Oh, I've got neck pain. And, you know, it was a low mechanism crash, but they've got neck pain and they fail one part of the nexus criteria. And you're going to have to immobilize them. That's the kind of person I think clearly, you know, that if you have the capability, if you've got a foam line board or an air mattress board or something along that line, yeah, that's probably a good thing. Again, I don't think you're harming anybody, and it may help, you know, make them a little bit more comfortable. As opposed to the, you know, the obtunded or comatose patient who has been involved in a major medical, a major motor vehicle crash, and may have spinal injuries along with a lot of other things, that person's out of it. It doesn't matter so much. But I do think immobilization is important there. It just, you know, whether it's a hard surface or not really doesn't matter to that patient. So, but if it were me, I think I'd take immobilization as a precaution.
And Tim, you said no?
That's right.
And what would be your reasoning?
There's still no evidence to show that this does anything to minimize the injuries that any kind of spinal injuries. We had somebody as an expert decide this is the reasonable thing to do, but we still haven't tested it other than the Haswald study in Malaysia, which was too small to be definitive and nobody's likely to repeat it. We need to say, hey, we're going to treat a patient with something. We need to show that it's both safe and effective. And nobody's claiming that we need to do that, or very few people are.
So the next tattoos that EMS providers are going to get is, it's going to say no C collar on our neck and DNR on our chest, and I could just, you'll be all tattooed up just so that people won't treat you. So Kyle, what about you? Where would you fall in the realm of C collars?
Actually, fall into the middle. I think, you know, if you've got significant suspicion of a possible spine injury, and even the nexus criteria is kind of sketchy in personal opinion on some of the stuff. I know what they say, but on a padded board with possibly a soft collar or a Philly style collar, not the rigid extrication collars, you know, on that. And maybe just a head strap and not a chin strap. Just real simple. You know, only, and that, again, not being put on just because. Give me a reason why we're being put on. I got paresthesia, I got neck pain, my head went through the windshield 3 or 4 times. One of those things.
Your head went through the windshield 3 or 4 times? That was a really bad accident.
Yeah, I would probably want to be immobilized on that one.
Yeah, you might want to be immobilized. I think I fall somewhere in between as well. I've been on a backboard and it stinks. That's all I have to say. Yeah, I laid in the ER for quite far too long and really didn't enjoy it that much. So, yeah, not a lot of fun.
I'm wondering if we should look at collars. I mean, you know, get away from the backboards. Look at maybe different style collars, going back to the various collars that are out there.
Well, that's true. You could. I mean, you know, and I think that maybe the design of them, too, is not the greatest anymore. You know, we looked at one at EMS Expo called the X Collar, and it was real. And full disclosure here, they have advertised once on our program, and that was it. But I actually got to see it at EMS Expo for the first time, and it fully immobilizes from the very almost top part of the back of the head all the way through, like, T7, T8, I don't remember. It was really low. And the way it all cinches up and goes around and really creates, it makes the entire neck immobile. Although it's still a rigid collar, and I'm not sure that that's the best way to go. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the answer is until we get more research. And unfortunately, the lawyers won't let us do that much research on it because the standard of care is X.
And of course, you know, what if most of the patients, you know, any patient that would have high suspicion of injury is probably unconscious or obtunded on in that aspect, or combative. So ones who aren't, they spend the whole ride going to the hospital doing what? Pulling at the collar. But
Kyle, you're really noisy.
Something
happened to your mic.
How's that? How's that better?
No, worse.
Oh.
Wow, this it's degrading bad. Are you there still, Kyle?
I'm here.
No.
Hello. Test.
He sounded really bad there at the end. we'll get Kyle back here in a minute because he was saying something. But Dr. Ross, how about you? I mean, do you think that there's a perfect...
This has been one of those weeks, hasn't it, Chris?
It has, unfortunately. That's why I'm going to name this podcast the podcast that almost never existed.
Ooh.
So, Dave, where do you fall as far as the design of a C-collar? Do you have an opinion on that? Oh, he held himself. Kyle, what were you saying? Kyle?
Hello?
Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, yeah. Kyle, what were you saying?
Hang on a minute here.
You're back completely.
Am I sounding better?
Oh, yeah, much better.
Okay, oh, Dave is trying to call me.
Oh, that's funny. Hey, Dave, you back now?
There we go.
Chris?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, my phone's ringing. What do you want me to do?
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. No, that's good. Hey, so Kyle, what were you saying right before that?
Oh, man. Talk about squirrel.
Oh, that's okay. No problem. So I know exactly what you're talking about, which is really odd. Dr. Ross, where do you fall in the design of the ideal collar?
Wow, that's a great question. I do not know. I think, I have to say, you know, from everything that I've thought about in this, I'm leaning toward...
Oh.
Man, this podcast, I'm about ready to...
This is supposed to be the podcast that shouldn't be. There you go. There's a title.
There's the title. Absolutely. You know, and I think I have a feeling that the tubes are all messed up tonight for some reason. Let me try this again. Wow. That's good.
I don't know. What was I saying? I forgot. I saw a shiny object and can't remember.
Squirrel.
I hate squirrels.
Oh, that's a funny thing. Oh my goodness. Well, you know, this podcast is deteriorating quickly. Hey, did you guys get to take at least a look at those articles that I sent you? Because I think we've killed the sea collar thing, and I know it's going to come back because Dr. Tom Dunn and Mr. Will Dunn want to come on and talk about it separately. So I'm pretty sure we'll get them on to talk about it, and we'll definitely do that. But did you get a chance to look at the two articles?
And the other one was L.A. where the police took a patient and they didn't go to the hospital and died.
Oregon, yes, it was in Oregon, and the
okay.
Yeah, the police had apparently called the.
I'm back.
Hey,
sort
Dr.
of.
Ross. Can you hear us now? No, I guess not. Nobody
yeah.
can hear me. I'm just talking
about this is one of those
tonight.
Weeks, I
it
think.
It is, completely. I said all the tubes are clogged up. Must be the cheese.
Cheese.
What's the cheese? Maybe it's the Saints. I don't know. So we were just going to really quickly talk about the couple articles that I sent. One was basically that DC Fire is over budget for their EMS division. And yeah, well, that's not good. And you know what's funny is there's a lot of fire... and EMS companies around the nation that are over budget. I think it's just the state of the economy is part of it, but who knows. So did you guys have an opinion about those two articles at all?
I can't find them.
Yeah, I'd rather talk about the one where they left the patient with the police. There are times when there isn't anything you can do about it other than document that the police told us we cannot take this patient and we do not have a say in the matter. But that's not common. And I didn't get the impression that that was what happened in this case, or if it did happen, they certainly did not document it appropriately. It's something where you look at the picture, which I don't know if it was actually of that patient, and you say, yeah, everybody's standing around with their hands in their pockets. Where's my assessment?
Right. Well, and unfortunately, AMR did have to pay out for that, and it really wasn't the best. So it really wasn't the best choice, I guess, for them to have to pay out.
Yeah, we actually, I mean, being part of a police department unit, you know, we deal with that quite often. We kind of run the medical of our holding cells. And, you know, it comes down to time where we go up and we do an evaluation. And if we feel a patient needs to go to a hospital, we have to actually contact the captain and lieutenant and, you know, discuss to them with what's going on. But ultimately, it's really their decision as to where that patient goes and what do they do. Lots of documentation.
Right, exactly.
But they're pretty good about it.
It's like the documentation for not doing the right thing. You know, the right thing seems to be default, take them to the hospital, let them get checked out, make sure the local police department cannot take anybody with alcohol on their breath to jail until they've been checked out by the hospital. It's gotten a little bit crazy on the other end. But this is somebody who ended up dying from their injuries, I think it was. How do you miss that?
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes, too, it's hard to armchair quarterback when you weren't there and you don't have the documentation in front of you and you really don't know what's going on. But, you know, we've all been on those scenes where you get there and it's a chaotic scene. You go talk to the guy and he doesn't even want – I mean, he's – you know, the person in custody is just like, don't touch me. And it's like, sir, I just want to check you out real quick. And if you don't want to go, you don't have to. And how many of us have been in that situation, though, where you're just like, and then you have to document it to high heaven, but you can't make them go. You can't force people to go. And especially when cops are involved, it just makes it 10 times more difficult.
From the article, they said that the police signed the refusal form stating that they didn't want the guy to go, rather than the patient, who appears to have his hands cuffed behind his back and be face down on the pavement and hogtied, which, you know, is supposed to be a no-no, rather than having the patient sign it saying, I don't want to go. Patient, according to the article, was completely incoherent, and according to the article, that's what the EMS paperwork stated as well. How do you do a refusal with an incoherent patient?
That's very true.
And see, the hard part is that it sticks, and you know, it's a gray area. But you know, that patient's in the custody, you know, of law enforcement, and, you know, medically you can argue one side, and, you know, in terms of where that patient goes and what happens, it's really up to the officers and police, and puts them in a lot of liability when they do that. And again, Chris, I'm sorry, I don't have the article in front of me for that one. But, you know, it's kind of a hard thing to be in. You know, the patient's actually not refusing, but the law enforcement, agency is, refusing on behalf of that patient. And I agree with you, it's not right. Luckily, we never have to deal with that.
Exactly. I don't know. You know, I like I said, it's unfortunate when we have to pay out or a company has to pay out because of that, but. You know, again, we don't know what all the circumstances were, and we don't know everything that happened there either. So, and
I get the impression that if they had documented better,
right,
that they wouldn't have had this problem, because, they're going to go through it in court. And when you write a refusal, my refusals are much longer than any transport, except maybe a cardiac arrest. But that's just, lots of EKG strips causing the length of it. It's not lots of interesting reading. My refusals are going to be the ones with the longest paperwork, and that's because I'm the only one who's going to say this.
Hello?
That's right. Well, and you're the one that has to sit there, too, at the same time and fight in court. Hello, Dr. Ross.
Oops. Goodbye.
Dr. Ross. I think there's something going on with his computer, and he just can't...
I feel
so bad for him tonight.
Tell you, the podcast that shouldn't be.
That podcast that shouldn't have been. Oh, well, all right. Well, you know what? I'm going to close this puppy down because we're at 50-some minutes, so it'll be perfect. So good night for Dr. Ross, because he's here, and he's the medical director for AMR in Colorado Springs. He writes an occasional column for EMS1, and you can find him there, and go read his stuff and contact him that way. Kyle David Bates, how can we find you?
KyleDavidBates.com. You can get all sorts of information about me there.
This might be the roughest podcast I've ever done. Really sad. Oh, well. So, and are you working on anything cool right now? Doing anything?
No, a little bit of a break. Yeah, I'm not really doing too much. A little bit of a break now until we get the conferences going here in the spring and everything. Found out I'm going to Expo in September.
Nice. Very cool. And how about EMS today? No? Yes?
No, unfortunately. I'll be when's that? It's beginning of March, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I'll be at the FASNY, New York State Fire Symposium beginning, and then in Fairbanks, Alaska at the end of March.
Yeah, you did say that. That's all right. I do remember that. Well, good night, and I hope you have a nice night at work, and it's not too cold and nasty for you.
So do I.
And Mr. Tim Noonan, the Rogue Medic, where can we find you, sir?
Roguemedic.blogspot.com and at paramedicine101.blogspot.com.
Very cool. And any new articles coming out? Any new blog? Any postings?
Well, I will probably end up writing something about that other paper that Dr. Bledsoe sent out on text differences. Just because that's a great example of how not to do research. It was such a horrible paper. Yeah, they had good intentions, but how did it get published in Academic Emergency Medicine? How did it get published anywhere? Good paper to look at for how not to do research.
Good.
And then there's another one on Wikipedia, where Journal of Pharmacotherapy was looking at it and saying, well, they don't provide information on dosage. But if you read the Wikipedia contribution paperwork, it says, do not include dosage unless there's something particular about the dosage, because we don't want them getting their dosage information from us. This is not the appropriate place for it. So the conclusion of that article was that the information in Wikipedia is incomplete and therefore unreliable. It's like, not at all. It's very complete where it's supposed to be.
Interesting.
So I've got a bunch of stuff I'm working on.
Well, very cool. I can't wait to read them, and you can find them there. Well, thank you guys very much for joining us. You can find me, Geeky Medic, on all the websites, Twitter, Facebook, whatever you want to find me, you can find me that way, and just Google me and add me as your friend or follow me, because I will try and follow you back if as long as you are a real person, because I get a lot of spam on Twitter, which is really odd. So thank you for joining us. Maybe next week we can talk about the iPad and what that means from Apple. You know, I'm really this is not a tech podcast, but boy, you know, I think that could have some pretty serious implications for EMS, and if it truly works as billed, it could be pretty cool, and I could see some pretty neat applications coming out of it. Now, if we could just get all those vendors to move all their stuff from Windows to Mac OS, we might have some kind of really cool EMS data entry things. So anyway, who knows, someday maybe. Thanks for joining me. Join us next week when we talk more about issues that concern you.